Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable, everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined today by my colleague, friend, and co-host, Judge Gail Williams-Byers. She's retired as well. We're both retired judges, and we thought that we'd take this opportunity to give you our insights into the legal process. So today we're going to explain jury instructions and also give you some insight into the process of jury deliberations. Judge Gail, jury instructions, complex, complicated, too long, too involved, but necessary in every single case. Can you give us a quick and dirty definition of what a jury instruction actually is?
Absolutely. And so I chuckled when you said too long, because how many times have you and I, perhaps even during our lifespan of practicing, sat there and, oh my gosh, had to listen through the multiple pages of jury instructions being read aloud into the record to the jury. So when you have a jury trial, you have 12 individuals and perhaps several number of alternates that are there for the purpose of, at the conclusion of the case, having the law explained to them. Because so far, up until that point in the case, they've had the evidence presented. And they, as the jurors, as the finders of fact, they determine what, based on what they've heard, is the evidence or what the facts are. But the judge has a special responsibility at the conclusion of all of the evidence presentation, meaning after all the witnesses have testified and all of the summations or closing arguments are done, the judge then instructs the jury on the law. And that simply and essentially means the judge explains to the jury what the law says about what they may ultimately find to be facts, or how they determine or marry those facts with the law in order to make a determination about how to come to an appropriate conclusion in the case.
Now, simplified, that means the jury finds the facts, the judge gives them the law, the jury then applies the law to those facts to arrive at a verdict. Is that right?
Bingo. And, you know, Judge Tom, I just should have bounced the ball back to you and said, here, take it away, because you are absolutely right. That's precisely what happens. That is the recipe, if you will. And that is something that happens in courtrooms every day in America, especially where, and essentially where you have jurors. If you just have the judge deciding, then guess what? Hopefully your judge doesn't need instructions for themselves. Hopefully they are well-learned and versed in the law. So the judge will never instruct themselves. But when there's a jury trial, there absolutely is the need to give instructions or definitions for what's going on. And these definitions don't fall out the sky. So let's engage a little bit also in dispelling perhaps some myths or misunderstandings. The judge make this up.
No, the judge doesn't make it up. And let me clarify just a couple of things. And sometimes you hear these called the jury charge as well as jury instructions. Those terms are synonymous. They
Absolutely.
Mean the same thing. So if you hear somebody saying the judge is giving the charge to the jury, that's the same thing as reading the instructions. Secondly, those instructions have to be read by the judge into the record. In other words, the jury has to sit there and listen. Sometimes, in some states and in some jurisdictions, the jury can receive a written copy of that to take to the jury room.
Absolutely.
However, in the Trump case in New York, there was some controversy about this. Judge Merchan's jury instructions were 55 pages long. I posted them on the Next Witness Please Facebook page if you would like to go read through them and see what instructions are really like. But they're long, and in New York, they're not allowed to take the jury instructions, the written instructions, to the jury room. That's not permitted. In Ohio, most other states, yeah, you can do that. And that makes it much easier. But that was not the case in New York. And it caused some confusion.
And can I just jump in here just quickly and say that what you said right now is so important, I think, for our listeners, is to understand that some of these procedural rules or process or how things happen, they are not standardized nationwide. These are not rules that every state you go to will follow them perfectly as you may understand them in your home state. So for those of you who are actually enjoying our podcast and these conversations and you're in the great state of Idaho or Utah or Massachusetts, Texas, or wherever, understand that the rules in your state might very well be different from the process rules in another state like New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, etc. That's, again, it doesn't offend the process of how jurors receive information or how they get the instructions. It's just a matter of process of what they do after those instructions are given, just like you said. So no need over your skis on this.
Yeah, an example of that too, Judge Gale, is the last time we talked about closing arguments. In most states and in the federal system, the prosecution goes first, then the defense, and then the prosecution gets rebuttal. In the state of New York, it's quite a bit different. And we saw that in the Trump trial where the defense had the opportunity
to go first
mm-hmm. and then the prosecution had one bite out of the apple and went last. So these things vary from state to state. What we're trying to give you, the listener and the audience, is a sense of how this works. And some of the mechanics are the same. So let's get into the mechanics of putting together a jury instruction. They just don't start from scratch, right?
Oh, no. And if only there was some kind of special fairy dust that judge could just, you know, dip into and sprinkle and then, you know, magically the instructions would appear. I suspect lots more people would want to be judges and to do this work. But it's really intensive. First of all, for a case of this magnitude, the judge has to first understand the charges. And every charge has what are called elements. And we talked about elements to charges or crimes in a previous podcast. So if you didn't catch that, I'm going to invite you to go back about two episodes and catch our episode where we talk about the actual charges and what those elements are and the duty of the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt every essential element. So the court has to instruct or define for the jury what those elements are and also what some of those important terms are. Now, in many states, if not most, the state legislature actually has a hand in this because they create the laws that are ultimately codified or become codes or ordinances. And the court relies on that definition or those crime distinctions, and they actually use that information to place that inside of the instruction to say, you know, the defendant has been charged with the offense of assault. In order to prove the charge of assault and to find the defendant guilty, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did X. And they may actually read the definition of what assault is as given by the state legislature and the definition that they provide in the state's code. This is what
knowingly causing physical harm to another, knowingly causing or attempting to cause physical harm to another.
Exactly.
Then the judge has to say what knowingly is.
And that's called the mens rea. Yes.
What's physical harm? What's an attempt to cause physical harm? All of those then have to be defined in a subset of definitions.
Absolutely. Which is how you can get to 55 pages and your eyes glazed over in no time. Absolutely. And so what also happens is in this process of the judge creating and pulling together these instructions, they may also invite both the prosecution and the defense to propose additional instructions after the court has provided the basics. This is sometimes a collaborative effort between both the prosecution and the defense to say, okay, here's what the court intends to instruct the jury on. Does the prosecution or the defense have anything additional that they're requesting? Do you have any objections to certain instructions being included? Meaning, do you not want them included? Do you not want them in there? Are you opposed to me instructing or explaining this portion to the jury? And if so, why is that? And let's talk about it. Because both sides generally have some input into what the final instructions are going to be to the jury, such that it's not a surprise to anyone in the room when the jury is instructed on certain things.
So let me go through just some mechanics here and see if you agree. This is the way I would do it when I did jury trials, is that I would prepare an outline of what I was going to charge. And some I used the exact wording, some I just used like bullet point outlines. I gave them to the attorneys ahead of time. And then after the evidence has been presented, and before this is outside of the presence of the jury, and before closing arguments, we have this give and take between the attorneys and the judge on how to tailor those instructions, or if they want special instructions. The judge then has to decide what to include or what to exclude. Then the judge usually does a draft of the instructions, gives that to the attorneys. The attorneys read through them and they either agree or they can object on the record, which means that they're saying the judge is instructing inappropriately, we think, and therefore, we're going to preserve that for the appellate court to look at a later time. So all of that takes place out of the presence of the jury and usually before closing arguments. Now, why before closing arguments? Because the attorneys need to know what the judge is going to instruct so they can tailor their arguments accordingly. I always thought that was vital to get that out of the way first.
I agree. I absolutely agree that it is imperative to get that kind of resolved and out of the way. And as you just described, the court could actually be going through this process and negotiation, if you will, with the prosecution and the defense throughout the life of the trial about the jury instructions. And this can sometimes create a little bit of back and forth, but it is not always just a one and done. For example, if there's information that comes out during the trial that maybe neither side necessarily anticipated, but it nonetheless is disclosed. So if it was a case where now all of a sudden there's evidence that the defendant fled or ran through, you know, during the time of an interaction or while allegedly committing an offense, the prosecution might ask for what's commonly called a flight instruction. And that instruction would say something to the effect of, well, you can discern or determine consciousness of guilt based on the defendant's actions. Running away from a scene might be one of those ways to determine consciousness of guilt. And because there's evidence that said that the defendant ran away during this time, we want the jury to be instructed that they can consider that for purposes of knowing or creating that what we call mens rea, or that mental state, and acting on it in the commission of an offense. That is something that is absolutely, it's not always anticipated. You may not know that as a defense attorney or as a prosecutor when the trial begins, but it may be something that you ultimately ask the court to include when it's time to give instructions to the jury. Why? Because maybe it came up in the middle of testimony, and my golly, that might be the linchpin for your case.
There are a lot of things that are always included in the jury instructions, and these, you sometimes hear the word tossed around in legal parlance, boilerplate. It means that they're used time and time and time again. You get them from instruction books. You know, each state has a book of instructions the judges can take this language from. Things like, The jury determines the credibility of each witness, and then determines what the jury can use to determine credibility, defines proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And we've joked before that that can go on to about four pages
of, at least
of description. But there are these things that that the jury verdict must be unanimous. These are the kinds of things that are standard in every jury instruction. Then there is a second part, which are the elements of the particular offense that the defendant is charged with. And then there's the third element, which Judge Gale just really described well, and that is special things that come up during a trial. Another one, she used an example about flight, but another one comes up that a person cannot be convicted based solely on the testimony of a co-conspirator.
Correct.
Now, that gets complicated, but what that basically means is if two people were doing a crime and one person was being on trial, the jury couldn't find that person guilty just based on the testimony of his or her partner in crime.
Right, well, of the partner in crime.
There would have to be other testimony, other documents, other eyewitness testimony, other even circumstantial evidence, but there would have to be other evidence. That would come up perhaps during a trial, and that would be a fourth category, which I call special instructions.
You're absolutely right. And also, I would also suggest that, and for me, this is what I always included as part of my jury instructions, is in addition to those special instructions, always making sure that in this sense that this is a process where you have human beings involved, judges are human beings as well. And so I'd always remind jurors that if anything during the life of this trial that I had done gave them any indication that I may have even possibly favored one right side over another, the prosecution more so than the defense, I'm not expecting, and I would hope that the jury wouldn't take score on how many times did she, you know, sustain their objections and how many times did she overrule the other side. It's not personal, but I want to remind the jury that if there's any indicia at all that they took away from anything I said or did that might have them believe that I favored one side or another, I want to include an instruction in there that they disregard it, that they completely only focus on the evidence and that they focus on the facts as they determine it to be, but certainly no notions, preconceived or otherwise, as to how I might feel about anyone in the room. Because let's just face it, okay, Judge? The judge is perhaps one of the most important people and certainly the most powerful person in the room. And there are some times that as a human being, you can give off certain responses.
Vibes.
Yeah, and vibes. Yeah, right, right? The vibes that will have anybody believing, oh, she cannot stand him, or he is really, really upset with that person, which is why I actually tip my hat to Judge Mershon in this case on the incidences where he would clear the courtroom before he would make certain pronouncements. So if he was planning to admonish someone or to make sure that the record is clear, it's always a good practice to escort the jurors out of the courtroom and then make the record outside the hearing of the jury, because you don't give the impression that, again, you have some feelings of discontent or favor for one side or another, which could actually color the perception of the jurors. I don't know if you tracked the Alex Murdaugh case in South Carolina, The sentiment was that the clerk of courts, an extension of the judge, was actually allegedly engaged in behavior that could color how the jurors perceive the defendant. And so that's an important instruction to give the jury to say, hey, whether it's me or if it's anyone who represents me, so that's the clerks, the bailiffs, anyone, please disregard that and make your decision so that your decision, your verdict is solely and exclusively yours.
You know what my trick was to keep an even keel in court?
What's that?
Okay. I'm sharing a judicial secret here. Sometimes, even though we're dealing with deadly serious matters, sometimes things are really funny in court, or you perceive them as funny and you want to chuckle or laugh or smile. Sometimes you get really ticked off as a judge, and you want to show that, but you can't. You can't do either one. You can't laugh, or you can't yell or grimace or have that stern look. So whenever I felt that I was ready to go over the edge, either way, laughter or anger, I would, because I had to have my robe on, I'd reach down and I'd pinch the inside of my thigh.
What? Oh my, when I tell you, I would probably look like I've been beat up by a dozen baseballs if I'd done something like that. My thighs would look terrible because of all the craziness I saw.
Mine did. that's how I would keep an even face.
Wow.
If I was about to laugh or if I was about to go off, just pinch the inside of my thigh and bring me right back to reality.
Well, then you'd probably be in tears, or at least I would be in tears. I'm like, never mind me. I'm not sympathizing with the witness. I'm just in pain.
Now, once the instructions are together, and we said the judge has to read them to the jury, one of the things that I did, I don't know whether you did this, Judge Gale, but one of the things I did is I would give each juror a copy of the instructions, a written copy, and I would say, I want you to read along with me as I read these instructions to you. You can make notes on these instructions. You can underline things. You can do whatever you want. This is your copy of the jury instructions. You can take it into the jury room with you. You can refer to it as you're reviewing the evidence.
Now,
I would do that on every major trial, and it cut the amount of jury questions more than in half.
Really? I think that's a really innovative approach. And now with, courts being so much more technologically advanced, like in, many of the federal courts, they have the digital screens. So they have them, the jurors have them at their seats. I wonder if there's a way to perhaps cast the instructions to the screen so that they could follow along. What I would do, as opposed to providing each juror a copy of the instructions, I would, because again, the law provides for that, is to provide jurors with a copy of the instructions. And so I would make sure that they had a copy of instructions that went back to the jury room with them for deliberations. And in fact, what I would ensure was prepared for them was a small binder that had jury instructions, but then it would also have exhibits that they could, in fact, refer to. If there were photographs, they would be in a particular order. I'd make sure that they were in order, but I'd also ensure that both the prosecution and the defense reviewed the binder before it went to the jurors again, so as to limit, you know, any objections to it, because sometimes you can have exhibits that find their way into the binder that weren't actually admitted during the testimony. So you want to make sure that only the evidence that's admitted actually goes back to the jury for them to consider along with those instructions. But I agree with you. Being able to give jurors the opportunity to take notes, and because what you would otherwise be doing is you'd rely on them to recall their collective memories of what happened.
Well, in the Trump case, they came back and they had Judge Mershon ask or give them the jury instructions a second time, because they didn't have them in the jury room. I'm sure they had questions or they wanted to rehear something.
And the truth is, can you imagine how many times they've probably done this in many, many, many instances in New York where they're not permitted to give the jurors the instructions? So this is, I'm sure, wasn't Judge Mershon's first rodeo. And
no, common practice.
It's
probably
common practice. They probably prepare for it to some degree, especially when you have difficult or even complex cases. And here we're talking about a criminal case, but quite frankly, sometimes civil cases can be extraordinarily complex. And so if you think about the fact that you cannot provide the jurors with those instructions, but instead they can always come back and ask for them again, I suppose the jurors could always, you know, they could develop a pact amongst themselves and say, hey, look here, y'all, we're not going to get the jury instructions, but everybody's got to write down one page of the instructions. Longhand. So as the judge is talking, somebody's got to write them so that we can have something that resembles the instructions by the time we go back. But they probably don't know that they're not going to get the instructions. And so they are preparing. And I think the jurors in this case were taking notes all along. It wouldn't surprise me if some of them took notes even about the instructions. But remember, if you're not used to this process, you are probably more focused on just getting and retaining the information that's being given to you by the judge and not necessarily taking copious notes to refer to later, because you're trying to absorb all of this new information and understand basically the instructions on how to make this, how to pull this puzzle in your mind together to make it make sense.
As we said, in most states and in the federal system, jury instructions can be given to the jurors to take with them to the jury room. New York, not the case. The highest court in New York, which is called the New York Court of Appeals, in a case made a decision that the jurors only could take to the jury room what was evidence, which means that all they could take were the documents and the exhibits that were admitted during the trial, along with their personal recollections of the testimony. So no transcripts were allowed.
No transcripts. At best, it seems like, you know, maybe they could take their own notes with them, because they were permitted to take notes throughout the trial, but they did not and were not permitted to take the actual jury instructions as given by the judge, because the jury instructions are not considered evidence. And they're not considered evidence any more than the arguments, the summarizing arguments or closing arguments of the defense attorneys or even the prosecutors. No matter how long they give them for, it doesn't make it any more evidence than even the instructions as provided by the court itself. So I can understand quite clearly and completely why you would have jurors, many of whom have never, ever done this before, saying and taking their responsibility very seriously, which we want jurors to do, but taking that responsibility seriously, but not understanding every single word that is on all 55 of those pages, or even remembering and recalling them so that they can actually do their jobs once they go to the jury room to deliberate. So my heart kind of goes out to the jurors for having gone through this process. But I also think, again, if we manage our expectations, just know that that's New York. It's not necessarily the rule elsewhere, but it could be the rule, depending on what jurisdiction you're in and what state and what court that you're in. That could very well be something that is encountered, just like the expectation that prosecutors would have two bites at the apple by doing an opening, closing, and then what we call a closing close. That didn't happen. So we're, you know, constantly managing expectations for minor changes in process based on what court you're in.
Judge, let's go to jury deliberations, if
must
we could.
Must we?
And let me state right at the outset for everybody, judges are not in jury deliberations. You know, so what we're going to tell you is the process that we have learned from talking to jurors after various trials.
Yes.
How they went about making their decisions. Now, in some states and the federal system, the first thing that the jurors do is pick a foreperson.
Which is also part of the instructions. That is usually one of the instructions the judge gives them.
But in New York, the foreperson's picked before the jury ever goes into deliberation. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, a quirk of the New York courts. But in most courts, the first thing they do is pick a foreperson to lead the discussion, to let things unfold, to make sure that order is maintained and everybody gets a chance to speak.
Right. And remembering that the foreperson does not have any greater voting authority over any other juror that is in the room, but their role, just as you said, is designed to ensure that there's no, what I like to call, chilling of speech, meaning you may walk into a jury deliberation room and there may be quite a few in the jury that have very strong opinions one way or another. Depending on those personalities and how strong those opinions are, it could have the effect of chilling or closing out or causing other jurors to not speak, to not participate, to not engage. Remember, this is a process that requires, if there is to be a conviction, there is a process that requires unanimity.
Or an acquittal, right?
Or you need one person to hold out and be strong enough to hold out, even amongst perhaps strong personalities, against a vote to convict. But yes, if there is an acquittal, there must be unanimity. If there is a conviction, there must be unanimity. If there is a hung jury, well, that means that there are there's a split where there are some jurors who believe that the defendant should be convicted, while others believe that the defendant should be acquitted. And even if it's only one other that believes that the defendant should be acquitted, then that is still a hung jury because a unanimous verdict is required for any conviction for any criminal offense. And you're right, Judge, when you talk about not having been involved in the deliberation process, because the deliberation process is one that is sacred. It is to be held just between those who are the deciders and determiners of fact. There shouldn't be any outside influences either. The folks in that room, those 12 jurors that have been identified and have taken an oath to faithfully abide by the law and apply the facts as they determine them to the law and to make a determination, should not feel any pressure or stress from any outside influences when they are going through that process. Because as we said before, even at the top of this podcast, at the end of the day, this decision has to be made for every single individual. It is one unto themselves. They have to make it for themselves, even though they are making it in concert with others. And I think about this, when I think about this, you know, Judge, I think about a situation that I had even when I was on the bench. And we talk about how jurors deliberate, and they should be able to deliberate in a process that does not only is the judge not there, the prosecutors aren't there, the defense attorneys aren't there, the law enforcement and anyone else. Witnesses are not there. They're not permitted to be involved. And I will never forget being on the bench, and in the courthouse that I was in, the jury deliberation room was often shared with the local city council for their meetings. And there came a time, and I don't know if I ever told you this story, but there came a time when the police department on its own just decided that instead of sending an officer to stand in the room in case council meetings, you know, became a little spirited, instead of doing that, they just decided on their own that they would just cut a hole in the ceiling in the jury room and drop a camera into the jury room. And their entire justification was, well, the council members sometimes have meetings in here and we need to know if things get out of hand so we can respond. And I was just like, I am clearly talking to people who are on a steady diet of rat poison, because there is no way in this world where you can convince a jury that their deliberations are being respected and honored when you have literally dropped a camera in the ceiling and you can watch them. You can watch and you're the police. You are often a party to these cases. So that means when the prosecution is presenting their cases, one of you guys are usually sitting right next to them. How dare you then walk into the jury with the jurors and essentially spy on them as they are here deliberating? It was just mind-boggling. First of all, the level of disrespect to the court, but also just to jurors and the jury process, that it was just mind-boggling that anyone could justify that. So I say that to say, we don't do that to jurors and still call it a fair process.
No, the secrecy of deliberations is sacrosanct. I mean, it is something that you don't challenge. However,
no cameras in the ceiling. What?
however, since the Trump verdict, the 34 convictions, I'm seeing some people now, not only through social media but through the regular news media, talking about jury deliberation should be open and that the defendant should have a right to be there.
As part of deliberations,
that is hogwash. That is pure, unadulterated hogwash.
And imagine the ability of an accused to, you know, influence those deliberations, depending on who you are. Oh my gosh! Would we have invited John Gotti to the deliberation?
Yeah, to sit
room?
In on his jury deliberation.
This is what we would do. It seems that it is. First of all, I think it comes certainly from an emotional place for anyone who thinks that. But also, I also don't think that most people truly understand that this is what's happening in courtrooms across America every single day.
It's the sanctity of the process.
The sanctity of the process is just being eroded. And can you imagine who's going to volunteer to sit in every court in all of America every single day to ensure that you, for whatever reason, that you're part of jury deliberations? Now, again, courtrooms are open. If you want to see the process, then you can watch the court process just about anywhere at any time because courtrooms are open. But you're absolutely right, Judge, when you talk about the sanctity of deliberations and to be able to do that without fear or favor. I think the very thing you introduce by insisting that these deliberations be made open and public is that you kind of impose fear or favor.
A couple of other things I think that we need to talk about as far as jury deliberations. We talk about jurors doing it different ways. And one way, a common way, is that the jurors go in and they take what they call a straw vote, an early vote to see how far apart jurors may be on whether they're voting for not guilty or voting for guilty. Those that are on the fence, so they take a straw vote on each and every one of the charges. Now, that's totally up to them whether they do that. You know, that it's, again, the deliberation is run by the foreperson of the jury, and they make that determination. Sometimes they don't want to do that. They want to establish, can we all agree on what the facts are of this case before we go any further? And, I've heard them do all kinds of variations of those two things, correct?
Absolutely. And either one, well, I'll say it this way. Either way can be correct. There's no wrong way to do that because it is, again, it is a process that the jurors themselves get to own. They get to decide. You don't have to pulse check everyone from the moment that they come in and they take their seats and now they're ready to begin the process. It may not be necessary to do that. Now, I will tell you, I've had some instances when even as a prosecutor, I completed the trial, you send the jury to the back because the judge has completed the instructions, and the waiting game can really, really feel like it's anxiety inducing. And you always feel like, okay, if the jury takes too long, this isn't breaking well for the prosecution. So I would often hope that they would go back and they do the straw poll and everybody's on the same page. So come on back in 45 seconds. And I'll tell you, Judge, one time I had a case where the jury did just that. They departed to go deliberate. I don't know that everyone even had a chance to use the restroom. And before we knew it, the judge was calling us back. And I said, "Whoa, that was the quickest verdict I had ever gotten." And I just knew that this case was it was a winner. And this was the quickest not guilty I had ever seen in my life. And I wanted to send them back and tell them to try again. But usually the sign was if they came back within, an hour, 2 hours, they had certainly given it the due diligence and they made a decision. These people came back, I think, in 45 minutes. And I was just like, did everyone use the facilities? And it was a not guilty. I was mortified.
I had one that they went in and they voted. They did a straw poll and it came back unanimous for guilty, 30 seconds, a minute into the deliberations. And they all decided that they would sit in the jury room and chat with each other for 20 minutes because they didn't want the defense attorney to feel badly.
We did this pretty quick, y'all. So how about we go around the room and do introductions and also, tell us, what do you want to be in your next life?
Yeah, exactly. So, but one thing, we're talking about time and we should emphasize, there is no time limit on juries. To come up with a verdict. You don't say, well, this case is this complicated, you've got 2 days, or you've got so many hours. It's as long as it takes for the jury to arrive at a unanimous decision one way or the other, or to come back and convince the judge that they will never arrive at a unanimous decision.
Which is also interesting in and of itself, but you're absolutely right, especially where you have a multi-count indictment or you have several charges for the jury to consider. It, I think, is all the more important that you remind them and you empower them to take as much time as they desire, as they need. They can take breaks. They can structure their day any way that they want to. If they want to break for lunch as soon as they are released to begin deliberating, the court generally respects that. If they want to stop deliberating after a certain time, because I suspect that sometimes in heated cases, you can have some really impassioned folks on one side versus another. And if that's the case, then if you have a mindful foreperson, they may find that cooler heads prevail either after having a meal or after having a good night's rest, especially if you've been through a long day of testimony and you're digesting information. Or how about, everybody didn't hear that the same way, or they don't recall hearing that testimony the same way. It's not uncommon for jurors to ask for certain portions of testimony to be reread to them, or for them to be provided certain excerpts from either the transcript or the record so that they can all reach an agreement or understanding on exactly what the information was, so that they can now determine what the facts are and apply those facts to the law. So you're absolutely right. There's no egg timer. There's nobody there ringing the bell. There's nobody there that's evicting them saying, hey, 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 it's time to go. You got to get out of here. If jurors want to deliberate for days on end or for however long they choose to, then they are at liberty to do so. But what I will say is that once deliberations begin, however long it takes, those jurors are together. And so there is rarely, if ever, especially where there are serious cases, where there are multiple charges, and there's an awful lot of complexity to it, that's when judges usually consider sequestering or keeping the jurors together and away from the public. They may put them up in a hotel, but they always admonish them not to talk about the case while it's pending. But when deliberations begin, it's all the more important that they not be influenced by any outside factors while they're making that decision, which I think makes making jury deliberations public all the more a fatality to that system.
Once a jury has arrived at a decision, a unanimous decision, the jurors sign a verdict form. Each one of the jurors sign it, as well as the foreperson of the jury. Now, in a high visibility case like the Trump case, they did it by number. They didn't do it by name because they were trying to protect the juror's identity. But you either do it by number or by name, but you acknowledge that that is, in fact, your verdict. Now, let me just mention one quick thing about verdicts. Jurors in a criminal case are looking at whether or not the person is guilty or not guilty. Those are the verdicts that are available. Not innocent and not an acquittal. Because what the jury has found, if the jury has found someone not guilty, all the jury is saying is that the prosecution, the government, has failed to prove that the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Precisely.
The jury's not proclaiming that person innocent. And we use that term a lot, or we use acquittal. Those really aren't apt either. It's guilty or not guilty. Those are the only two choices.
And can I also note that even before getting there, there are times when jurors deadlock or they disagree. And this may go on for a while. And that at that point, a juror foreperson will signal to the judge, I mean, whatever manner the judge has designed. So it can be a message through the bailiff. It can be a note. It can be information that's transmitted that says we just can't make a determination, a unanimous decision. We cannot come to a unanimous decision, or we can't come to a unanimous decision on all charges if there are multiple charges. It may be that they can reach unanimity on some charges, but not all. And then we'll turn to the judge and essentially say, what do we do if we just can't get there? Under these circumstances, the judge can either respond by saying, continue to deliberate and merely say that only and return the jurors back to their work. They can also, if it's in particularly if it's at the request of the prosecution or the defense, depending upon how long the jury has been deadlocked, they can be given a special charge or a special instruction, which in some states is called an Allen charge. Others, it is called a Howard charge. But essentially, it is an instruction to the jury that says, listen, this is the evidence in this case. There are no jurors anywhere that are smarter than you, that are more equipped
than you, that are as disinterested as you are, and that are as capable as you are. Therefore, your deadlock can absolutely be resolved with a decision. You do not have to surrender honest convictions to the other side just to be amenable, but it is worthy of saying and reminding you to consider the arguments of your fellow jurors and consider the saliency or the germaneness or the appropriateness of your fellow jurors' arguments. And if you can find that that is appropriate and that they are based in facts that you share, then it is indeed possible to reach a unanimous verdict. But it does not, merely suggesting or saying that you are deadlocked and that you cannot reach a agreement at this time does not mean that you will not ever be able to reach such an agreement. And in fact, the court can instruct you to go back and try some more, but also reminding you that that there's never going to be a better case presented here, and there aren't going to be better jurors to make that decision. And so if not you, then why not? Because you're absolutely capable of making a decision in this case. And that sometimes does happen when jurors are not able to unanimously agree on all of the charges or the verdict for all of the charges that might be before them.
Translation, get back in there and do your work.
Try again.
Try again. Yeah. Keep trying, because it's not going to get any better. Once the jury does the verdict, let's assume that they come back with a guilty verdict, as they did in the Trump situation. That verdict is read, usually by the clerk, sometimes by the judge, sometimes by the foreperson of the jury. It depends on the state and the court and how they wish to proceed. And then there's one final thing that the defense can do, and that is ask that the jury be polled, mm-hmm. which means that the judge has to ask each one of the jurors to orally articulate their verdict. Now, I've never seen a juror weasel out on that yet. I've never seen a polling change the outcome, but it is an option for the defense.
And you're absolutely right. Jury polling can feel a bit intimidating because it's done in open court.
It is, yeah, and done. That juror's got to say guilty.
Yes, and they have to say it, you know, in this instance, they have to say it 34 times. Why? Because in order to make a good record, the court should go through each and every charge or each and every count in the indictment and poll or ask each juror what their verdict is for every single charge that is put forward in the indictment. And even after that is done, and even after each juror responds affirmatively, as I'm with you, I've never had a situation where a juror said, well, you know what? Now that I think about it, I'd like to change my mind on that one. Matter of fact, I want to change my mind on that in the next 12. I've never seen that happen ever.
I haven't either.
I'm not suggesting that. Maybe some judge somewhere, and if you have, we're going to ask you to go ahead and email us and inbox us, because I'd love to know the circumstances where you had someone that just said, I thought about it some more. But once that happens, you also then have the additional opportunity for the defense to ask the court to essentially set aside the verdict or the findings of the jury. That's called a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. It is a request or a motion by the defense that essentially says, Judge, the jury lost their way. Given the evidence and given everything that was presented, there is no way that even a group of reasonable people could find the defendant guilty of this offense or these offenses. And because of that, and because we believe that the jury has clearly lost its way, we're asking that you set aside or disregard or substitute your judgment for that of the jury's and find that the defendant is not guilty, even though the jury found that the defendant is guilty. That is what a JNOV, or judgment notwithstanding the verdict, is and what it's designed to do. I, in my experience, have never seen a judge substitute their judgment for the jury, but there's a reason why that is a tool available in the law, because there perhaps is this sentiment that your juries can lose their way, and judges, as the final check on the system, can absolutely come in and essentially save the day. And if they choose not to, then defense attorneys can preserve that issue on appeal and appeal to a higher court to say this was an error, an error that is so detrimental to the defendant that had the judge made the right decision, we wouldn't be here.
Well, we've gone through jury instructions and deliberations in depth. Let's end on not a frivolous note, but a lighter note, Judge Gale. Let's talk from a prosecution side and a defense side. All the old wives' tales, if that's still an appropriate saying, of how to read jurors. Now, as a defense attorney, you're right. The longer the jury was out, the better I felt, because I thought at least I might have a chance for a holdout, and I might at least get a hung jury.
Somebody's so back the there longer, fighting for you. Somebody's
the longer they were out, the better. You know, if the jury came back and didn't look at my client, they either looked the other way or looked down. I thought, oh, damn.
This is
not good. This is over. You know, so you try to read those things. If they came back and they looked, or there was a smile, then I was elated, but that rarely happened. So as a prosecutor, what'd you look for?
You know, I'd always get the stone face from the jurors no matter what. But I will tell you, I would always love prosecuting in a certain judge's court, because I knew the signal for a guilty, even if it was only one count, or if it was a multi-count indictment, and even if the jury only returned one guilty verdict, I always knew it. And in this particular judge's court, who will remain nameless, but is still near and dear to my heart, and I absolutely adore her, you always knew where there's a guilty verdict, because when the jury sat and she would always read the verdict, if the defendant was guilty of anything, she would always ask the defendant to stand as she read the verdict. And I knew if she asked that defendant to stand, now I'm just trying to figure out which one, which charge are they guilty of? Because that was the telltale sign. If they were not guilty and she was preparing to read the verdict and she never asked the defendant to please stand, then I knew that the defense should have a happy day here today.
Judge Gale, as always, this was fun. I hope people out there enjoyed it. Two quick things. We're not just on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and NPR Podcast Directory and Amazon Podcasts. We're now on Audible.
Oh, wow.
So if people want to pick us up on Audible, you can do that. But if they do subscribe, what do you want them to do, Judge Gale?
Listen, at this juncture, there is no excuse not to find us. If you subscribe, then we need for you to listen to us. We need you to rate us. We need you to review us. That lets us know how we are helping to enrich you. And we invite your feedback. We are having a fantastic time pouring into this audience and giving you what we believe is very helpful, insightful information on how the justice system works. And so we need you to spread the word, tell your family, your friends, and any and everyone who will even listen to you and give you an audience. Tell them to come join our audience, rate us, review us, and join us again.
And we want to thank all of you for listening to this episode of Next Witness, Please. As Judge Gale said, you can subscribe at your favorite podcast outlet, and please rate us and review us. If you have a question or something you want to know or something you want us to amplify on, please send an email. You can do that to my email address. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. That's Hodson at ohio.edu. Next Witness, Please is produced in conjunction with WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and our audio engineer. And Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Judge Gale, thank you.
Thank you, Judge Tom. Always a pleasure.
Have a good day, everyone.
Bye-bye.